is intended for all Quebecers. We must take extreme measures to curb the pandemic. Only essential services remain open. Gatherings are prohibited. It's forbidden to leave your home between 8 p.m. and 5 a.m. These efforts aim to protect our healthcare workers, seniors, and loved ones. Let's comply with the lockdown and curfew to lower the risk of contracting COVID-19. Because our health is important. For more information, visit quebec.ca/confinement. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
Good afternoon, everybody. This is Bassam Haddad and with my fantastic co-host, Libby Anker. Hi, Libby.
Hi, Bassam.
We are very excited to have our first inaugural podcast on Theory Buzz, and we are extremely honored to have our first guest be Professor Wendy Brown, whom Libby will introduce in just a second. Let me just say that Theory Buzz is an idea that we came up with in order to address the work of scholars and writers and authors who work on social theory. So there will be a podcast once a month, and we will share a lot of this material either below on the Facebook feed as well as on theorybuzz.com that you could check out anytime. The podcast itself will be available on YouTube for those who don't want to visit Facebook, as well as on theorybuzz.com. So with that, I will actually stop and give the floor to Libby.
Great. Thanks. We are really excited for our first podcast and especially excited to have our inaugural guest be Wendy Brown. I'm delighted to introduce her. Wendy Brown is a renowned political theorist and the class of 1936 first chair in political science at UC Berkeley. Her work on power, on political identity, and on neoliberalism has influenced a generation of scholarship on contemporary politics. Her most recent works include Undoing the Demos, Neoliberalism's Stealth Revolution, and the book that we're going to be discussing today, In the Ruins of Neoliberalism, The Rise of Anti-Democratic Politics in the West. Wendy's books have won many prizes and have been translated into 20 languages. It is our sheer delight to have Wendy here today. Wendy, thanks so much for joining us. And before we begin, I just wanted to do a quick check-in and see how you're doing in these pandemic times and how you're managing quarantine.
Libby and Bassam, thank you for having me. I'm absolutely honored to be here and to be your inaugural subject. this podcast just seems like a fantastic idea, the idea of bringing political and social theory to the bigger world and the things that we do inside the academy outside as well as inside just seems great to me. So congratulations on the podcast, and I look forward to talking with both of you. I'm doing fine. I'm the lucky, you know, part of the lucky crowd. I have my work, I have my income, I have my house, I have my healthcare, I have my well-being, and, you know, it's a world, as we know, that has revealed all the stratifications and inequalities and precarities through the pandemic. And it's no surprise that those of us who have all of those things are doing pretty well, and that mental and physical and social health declines as you move through the stratification ladder. So that's the short and political answer to how I am.
Great, thanks.
I should add one thing. My great salvation during the pandemic has been swimming in the San Francisco Bay. When the pools all closed here, a bunch of us got wetsuits and found our way to a daily regimen in the bay, and that has been transformative. And I've met a lot of seals.
It's also bold and invigorating for those of us stuck inside during an ice storm today. So
yes,
thanks for that.
Yes.
Great. My first question for you is really just a kind of broad question to open up to some of the large concerns of the book. Many of us think that we kind of know what neoliberalism is as the defining political and economic order of our time, right? That neoliberalism entails deregulating corporations, defunding the welfare state, dismantling public goods or privatizing them, and even that it works on us to ask us to kind of become the entrepreneurs of our own self. And yet your book offers a different view of this understanding of neoliberalism. Not that those things are wrong, but that they are incomplete or they don't get at the whole story. So I'm wondering if you can tell us kind of what is missing from these familiar interpretations of neoliberalism and what else should we be attending to?
Sure. You offered a terrific list of what we could call the economic view of neoliberalism, all the ways in which it takes the social state or social democracy and disintegrates it, and all the ways in which it unleashes capital, leashes labor, transforms public services, public goods into private ones, privatizes everything on the face of the earth, from education to prisons to governments to transportation systems and so forth. So there's all of that. And that is neoliberalism. There's no doubt about it. Many of the neoliberal economists understand substituting private for public control of economic and social life to be at its heart. But there are two other things that I think are really important to mention. The first is one that you already touched on very briefly, which is the extent to which neoliberalism from the beginning, even out of the mouth of Margaret Thatcher, one of the openly card-carrying neoliberals of the 80s, was always a project of a different way of constructing society and governing the self. The way Thatcher put it was, economics is the method, but the aim is to change the soul of human beings. And what she meant by that was cutting dependency on the state, eliminating the idea that we were a society and care for each other through that and through democracy and through the state, and instead becoming individually responsible for ourselves, self-investing, entrepreneurial, all the things our students know so well. They were born into this world of having to invest in themselves, both monetarily and socially, to enhance their own value, whether on social media or on their resumes or in their course choices or major choices or anything else. That was the other aim of neoliberalism. But in addition, neoliberalism was a rolled out as a whole different way of governing every institution, not just public and social ones, but also private ones. Schools are an example, but so is every business. The idea of entrepreneurializing every corner of every institution and every endeavor and activity. So the idea of neoliberalism as a form of reason, a form of governing, is a really important supplement to understanding neoliberalism simply as economic policy. And that's what most of us mean when we say all of society has been neoliberalized, that it's been that it's now governed by neoliberal reason. But there's one additional thing that I take up in this book that I think has been missing from most accounts, not all, but most accounts of neoliberalism. And that has to do with the fact that neoliberalism was never understood by its founders or by most of those who helped roll it out as merely replacing every form of governing ourselves, conducting ourselves, and organizing society with markets, but also with traditional morality. What do I mean? That what neoliberalism argues, whether in Hayek or Friedman or this odd group of neoliberals known as the ordoliberals, or many of the American Virginia School public choice neoliberals, what they all understand is that markets are one form of natural, as it were, organizing of us. But what Hayek calls evolved moral systems, that's the other form. So what's the significance of this? That what neoliberal reason does, once it really takes hold in society, is challenge the idea of democratically legislated norms, social justice, redistribution, what we today call racial justice, gender justice, and those sort of things, with the two legitimate forms of order that neoliberalism anoints: markets and traditional morality. Why are they legitimate? Because they evolved without states. They, according to the neoliberals, they evolved without the coercion of law or the coercion of legislative acts. Now, what's significant here, and I'll wrap this up now, is that this is essentially a challenge to democracy, to democratically determining how we should live, what is just, what is unjust, who should have what. It's a challenge to democracy and an attempt to dethrone democracy in favor of letting all those questions be answered by traditional morality on the one hand and markets, market distributions, market competition on the other. Traditional morality, I will just add as a final point, comprises, of course, the family, what we could call normative patriarchalism and so forth, but also the traditional order that we understand today to be stratified by race and even colonialism. That is to say, whatever evolved over time, the supremacies, the hierarchies, and so forth, are treated as essentially evolving because they served and the needs of human order and human beings, and in that sense aren't right in an absolute sense, but right in the sense of providing order and the good. And that's what neoliberalism seeded or set out as the seedbed for what was already a churning racism in most of the West, hailing from slavery, from colonialism, from native dispossession, and so forth. I promise the rest of my answers will be shorter, but we had to get back.
No, we love it.
Okay.
You're on point, and actually, we should have shared that this is an hour-long podcast, so we do have some time, except that we also do have some questions. And as we shared with Wendy before we came on live, we have about 2 or 3 days worth of questions, but she said, you know, maybe that's a bit much. So we'll wrap up in an hour. Wendy, thank you. Some of these questions might overlap, but we'd like you to, you know, to emphasize and hone in on some points. A key part of your argument is that neoliberalism foments rebellion against democracy. You write that, and I quote here, "Neoliberal rationality prepared the ground for the mobilization and legitimacy of ferocious anti-democratic forces in the second decade of the 21st century, and that because of these forces," another quote, "politics becomes a field of extreme and uncompromised positioning, and liberty becomes a right of appropriation, disruption, and even destruction of the social." So a couple of questions. First, what makes democracy so reviled? And second, how does the attack on democracy unite both hard-right authoritarians on the one hand and traditional neoliberal individualists?
Great. So the attack on democracy, just to extend a little the argument that I already made, is really an attack on the idea of legislating social policy, social justice, distributions, regulations, and so forth, instead of letting the market run free and traditional moral order do its work. So the view of the neoliberal intellectuals, and I would say the way that neoliberal reason operates, is to essentially disparage what political theorists like to call legislation of the good, what we decide is the good in society, and instead say these other two forms are essentially what generate the good. The attack on democracy goes a little further because it is also an attack on social justice as such. And here's where the writings of people like Hayek are very important, because he makes explicit that that social justice is A, a fiction, and B, a dangerous one. And in making that argument, he's suggesting that it encourages not only a tyrannical state, and you hear the right making this argument all the time, you know, it's totalitarian, it's dictatorial, it's tyrannical, and so forth, to make, for example, racial justice a priority and then attempt to enact it at the level of the state. So it not only produces an overreaching, overweening state, but it also disrupts traditional order or natural order. Now, here I think we can see a hard right that already was, we might say, no friend of democracy, empowered by this form of reasoning and essentially legitimated by this form of reasoning. And in that sense, what would have been to many in a pre-neoliberal period extreme and dangerous in much of the hard right, let's call it neo-fascist, neo-Nazi, Klan-type right-wing politics, becomes, as it were, legitimate speech and takes its own legitimacy not only from its the formulation of freedom that neoliberalism articulates, which is the freedom to do whatever you want in any way you want, put on steroids, but it also is legitimated by the anti-democratic force of neoliberal reason itself.
Many of these more recent developments, including this kind of hard right turn, or at least the merging in a certain way of what we, I think, erroneously separate as hard right views and traditional neoliberal views, right? The kind of merging of them, as you emphasize in the book, goes against the vision of neoliberalism that its initial purveyors created, right? So some of the phenomena that we're connecting together seem so opposite from the neoliberal focus on individual responsibility, as you were saying, or free market or rationality, even traditional morality. And I'm thinking here of some of the anger, the resentment, the authoritarianism, even the pleasure in domination that now seem to be somewhat the effects of these, you know, both neoliberal rationalities and policies. And I'm thinking here of something as well, like the Capitol riots, which was clearly not the version, you know, the vision, I should say, of Hayek or Friedman. And yet so many of the phenomena in your book seem to describe the precise conditions that led to the insurrection. And I just wanted to read a quote here from you that I think can help us say that. It's a paragraph long, but I think it's really helpful. You write, "The combination of neoliberalism's deprecation of the political and the social and a desublimated wounded white masculinity together generate a disinhibited freedom, one symptomizing ethical destitution, even as it often dresses in religious righteousness or conservative melancholy. It is a freedom unbridled and uncultured, freedom to put a stick in the eye of accepted norms. It is the freedom of, I will because I can, because I believe in nothing, and I am nothing other than my will to power." So this is not a freedom we would normally imagine fits neatly within the original contours of neoliberalism, but I think your book is insisting to us has to be understood as somewhat of its effect.
Great. All right, so this is a whole other point in the book itself, and I think in what needs to be our thinking today, which is to move away from the original architecture of the neoliberals to understand what the effects are of a form of neoliberal reason that are not, as you say, effects that they intended, or that many who were either, we could call them economic neoliberals or social or governmental neoliberals, intended. And that is precisely neoliberalism's intersection with a deep rage about class and race displacement from a certain entitled expectation about what the working and middle, the white working and middle classes in the Euro-Atlantic world thought they deserved, and would continue to have, But also, I think what's really important is to see where the neoliberals just didn't understand that the vision they had, which I'm going to say just a little bit more about in a second, neglected something very important. The vision they had was of an absolutely pacified, because entrepreneurialized and responsibilized, I'm going to explain those words, population. That is, if everybody's responsible fully for their own individual lives, for taking care of everything from their sustenance to their education, to their retirement, to their householding, that's what they are in a neoliberal understanding supposed to be busy with. And the assumption was that a fully responsibilized society, a society in which everyone is responsible for themselves, is far less politically agitated than a more democratized one, than a society in which we are active democratic participants in arguing about and determining what the common good is. So they imagined this essentially neutralization of political energies. And they also imagined a state that propped markets and morals without intervening in them, just propped and supported them, but itself was not active, agitated, and highly politicized. Essentially, they were trying to get away from all the fascist tendencies out of which neoliberalism was born, contextually, the fascism of Europe in the 30s. So neutralize the population, technocratize the state, and what do you end up with? A calm, orderly capitalist society full of inequality, but not full of all the rancor and resentment and mobilization and agitation that previous decades had featured and that they thought social democracy would also feature. And what we have instead is what you just depicted and what we've witnessed over the past 15, 20 years, which is a deepening political mobilization and agitation on the part of both right and left. So what does this mean? What was being neglected, I want to suggest, by the neoliberals is not so different from what is neglected by early 20th century Marxists as well, and experiments with Marxist states, namely the whole domain of political life and emotional life that needs to be attended to theoretically, practically, and we could say at the policy level, if we are to really try to make a just and orderly society, whether it's the neoliberal version, which has no attraction for me, and I assume most of your listeners, or whether it's a more socially just democratic version. In either case, you don't extinguish or expunge the political and political energies, which is exactly what the neoliberals imagined their order would do. And in either case, we have to take seriously the complex subjectivities, psychic formations, social psychic formations that arise in response to all kinds of things, not only economics, not only social conditions, but also something I talk about toward the end of the book, the steady development of what Nietzsche diagnosed as nihilism, the experience of a world without values having foundations, and also the steady development of a world in which horizons start to, as it were, disappear into the mist as we become more and more globalized, and all kinds of fear, rage, rancor, resentment, anxiety, we could even say madness, are the result. And these are things that the neoliberals, you know, had nowhere on their radar and are part of the reason that we end up with what I call a Frankensteinian version of neoliberalism rather than the one that its architects imagined.
Thanks, Wendy. Before we move forward, we're going to take a 5-second break, and Elizabeth or Libby said that it is okay for me to say this is not a pee break. It's just 5 seconds. So we'll be right back. That's it. Yeah, I promise you it's great.
Libby was right.
Wendy, we have been talking about separately also Libby and I, and we're wondering what is it in our society today, especially in the United States, that escapes neoliberalism. You share that nothing is untouched by neoliberalism, but you also share that we cannot reduce all phenomena or outcomes to neoliberalism. Can you address this? And I'll share a quote from the book. And the quote is, "The argument is not that neoliberalism by itself caused the hard right insurgency in the West today, or that every dimension of the present, from the catastrophes generating great flows of refugees to Europe and North America to the political siloization and polarization generated by digital media, can be reduced to neoliberalism. Rather, the argument is that nothing is untouched by a neoliberal mode of reason and valuation, and that neoliberalism's attack on democracy has everywhere inflected law, political culture, and political subjectivity," unquote. How do we navigate this, that nothing is untouched by neoliberalism on the one hand, but not everything can be reduced to it?
It's such a beautiful question. Thank you, Bassam. I think navigating is exactly the right verb here, because it is so tempting once one has something like an analytic framework for understanding a very big and important set of powers in the world, to start pouring everything into them. And we've all had that experience, and we've all seen our students have that experience. You finally get it, you know? And I had this experience for the first time as an undergraduate reading Capital. And it was an amazing moment. Capitalism explained everything from love and food to stop signs and my dreams. And on top of that, of course, all of the inequalities and commodifications and fetishisms and so forth in the world. And we've all had that moment. I think most intellectuals also have to be very careful, even after that undergraduate experience of it, about what I would call the will to power in an idea, which is a moment where one has an appreciation of a certain logic or a certain window on something. And the excitement about expanding the reach of that thought overtakes us. And I think a beautiful way to see this is in somebody like the work of Michel Foucault, because he was the master teacher of anti-totalization in thought. He was the guy who said, there is no one big explanatory system or set of concepts or anything else. And it's why each of his genealogies on madness, on sexuality, on prisons and discipline and punishment drew on different things and produced different understandings of the webs of power, even in the same age. He might be looking at the same century or the same epoch in each case. And yet, to read any of Foucault's genealogies is to find oneself in that very will to power, where you suddenly see the power of confession or the power of discipline everywhere. And I think it overtook Foucault himself in the course of his genealogy. So that problem that you have given us, which is the how do you simultaneously get hold of something like systemic racism, like patriarchy, like neoliberalism, like colonialism, like climate change, like the emergence of authoritarian, anti-democratic liberal regimes in Western democracies everywhere? How do you theorize those without being totalizing? And I think that the answer is to have that conversation just going on in your head all the time. So let's now bring it to what you just asked about. I do believe that it is difficult at this point to find, as it were, an uncontacted tribe vis-a-vis neoliberalism. It's very hard to find a people, an activity, a thing that hasn't been inflected in some way by neoliberal reason and neoliberal economic and social effects. At the same time, it would be a terrible mistake to treat, for example, the emergence of Black lives as a neoliberal effect or a retort to neoliberalism. It's a response to a long history of systemic racism in the United States that certainly has neoliberal inflections here and there and can be connected to certain aspects of neoliberalism, but there's no reason to reduce it or to put it under that umbrella. So that's where I just think, you know, we can find things that are, as it were, independent in their origin or in their development, and at the same time recognize and be alert to the ways that they're touched by it. I want to suggest that I do think those who treat something like the social anxiety ubiquitous in, say, Gen Z and millennials, to not see the contribution of neoliberalism to that is to really miss something big. So to reduce it to neuroscience on the one hand, or to economic conditions on the other, rather than understanding the hamster wheel that neoliberalism has put every young person on in terms of building their own brand, building their own value, fear of falling through a now non-existent safety net, and also fear of having no existential future at all, collectively or individually. We must bring neoliberalism to understanding that without reducing it to neoliberalism.
Thank you very much. We're going to take another quick break. It's a 5-second break, and we'll be right back.
Great, thanks. That was for everybody who needed a little 1-second dance break in between. Great, Wendy, my next question for you is something I have wanted to ask you for a while, and I'm really glad to have the opportunity to do it, because it's about this book, but also about your earlier ones, in the sense that I think one of your key interventions in both of your books is your emphasis on neoliberalism as a form of reason that shapes us as subjects, right? And I guess my question is, like, what makes it compelling to us? In the sense that, right, I can see why neoliberalism takes hold of governing orders or legal institutions, but what is it that makes us, if not want to is not the right word, but become compelled by, let's say, seeing ourselves as specks of human capital, or, you know, people who need to be invested in so that we can bank on our own future returns, right? Or, you know, even on the other hand, people who want to see that society doesn't exist, or that democracy is, you know, hatred to them, which is a way of them even giving up on their own political power to a certain degree, right? What makes some of these dynamics compelling? Maybe it's pleasurable, right? Kind of maybe where's the pleasure in some of these dynamics? So I guess that's just a kind of a set of terms to throw at you to see, you know, how you might make sense of it.
It's an important question, because it's too easy for neo-Marxists, and I put myself in that category, even though I think it's important to see neoliberalism as a form of reason rather than mere economics and ideology. But it's too easy for a neo-Marxist to say, oh, it's not about whether it's compelling. It's what, again, Thatcher got right in the acronym TINA, there is no alternative. It's that society governed by neoliberal norms leaves you no option. And let me just run that argument out before getting to your answer, your question. The argument here is that, you know, the young musician or the young techie who does not entrepreneurialize herself, who does not work on her brand, her value, and does not, as it were, take up the neoliberal imperative to self-provide, self-enhance, self-invest will fail. Can't survive. It can't be done. And I think many of us see this in academia all the time. You know, there's that kind of repellent side of the neoliberalization of academia where everybody's promoting their books and their little invitations and their this and their that all the time. And it can be quite disgusting and quite alienating, but that's easy for me to say. I don't actually have to do it to survive. Most of my graduate students have to. I mean, all of them have to. They can't afford the I am just an intellectual and I shall be discovered or valued or not. They have to engage in that branding and promotion. So that's the Tina answer. The answer that says we don't have to talk about what makes it compelling. We just have to ask why are people compelled to conduct themselves according to neoliberal reason. But I also think there is an attractiveness for many. And Foucault gave us a hint of this. The freedom, the self-invention, the self-crafting, that at some level is on offer. Whether it's the invitation to be an Uber or Lyft driver on your own terms, your own hours with your own car, and shut down when you want to and come back when you want to. That is, the gig economy more generally is, among other things, an offering of you do it your way. You don't have to be, you know, the little slave laborer for life of a company that has your pension and has your benefits and therefore controls you. No, it's all up to you. You make it, you decide when, where, how, you go off the grid, you come back on the grid and so forth. So I think that there obviously is something in that offer of freedom that built on already a liberal understanding of freedom. You're a self-made, self-crafting, self-choosing creature who decides what you value, what you want to do, and so forth. I think there is a big lie in there because we know the fate of Uber drivers. They may be choosing when, where, how they want to work, but they're not climbing out of poverty through driving for Uber. They may be deciding that Tuesday afternoon they'll go take care of the kids instead of driving, but that doesn't mean they're making ends meet, have health care, have a pension, or have what they need to get daycare that's high quality and protected and safe for their children so that they can get on with their own education or something else. So the idea of individual freedom, obviously built on an already a strong feature in liberal societies, and I think does attract. At the same time, I suspect you've had this experience, Libby. Whenever I begin in a class to explain human capital and what it takes to keep its value up, and I'm basically explaining students' lives for the last 10 years to them, you know, what it took to get in, to get to college, to get to this classroom, to try to stay awake in this class, you know, to do all that they've done. I have yet to hear one say, oh yeah, I love that. Usually yeah. What you get is a groan of recognition and oh my God, what else might be the alternative? There's often only then a realization that this is not the only way that life could be organized, that humans could be organized, that humans could be valued, but that sense that you could actually be part of something bigger than yourself, have social direction, have common cares, be engaged in something that fundamentally cared for the species on the planet rather than threw them into survival mode all the time. Most students respond to that with a recognition of horror, even if it looked attractive. So I think that is the other answer to your question, that there's something compelling without fully reckoning with the ways the bottom's falling out, the anxiety is rising, the constant fear of falling off the cliff is present, and so forth.
Great, thanks. That leads to a question that I think Bassam had about pedagogy, if maybe we want to go there.
Yeah, I mean, I one of the things we'd like to do. Thank you, by the way. That was wonderful, and we I mean, there are so many other questions, but we're trying to keep it to an hour. And our discussion earlier separately also focused on how we could address the material that you're sharing, and you know, future guests will share. In pedagogic terms, or how do we actually teach this material, or what is it that you might share with us that would be helpful for educators in the classroom? How does this look like you as in terms of how to teach neoliberalism and how you make neoliberalism speak to also the students' experience? That realm of pedagogy is something that we'd like to add to our discussion. If you have any thoughts on that.
Yeah. It's not easy for a number of reasons, not least because I actually find neoliberalism immensely complex, variegated, and differing over different times and places. And so even though we've been talking about some common threads, at the same time already we've talked about, well, there were the founding intellectuals who gave us the idea. Then there's the rollout, which is a little different. There's its economic policy. There's its governing policy. There are the early experiments in Latin America. There's the way that the IMF essentially was administering and governing the so-called developing world through neoliberalism long before people in the global north really got what it was, that whole period in the 70s when the IMF was already discovering what you could do with debt and austerity and so forth. So I've never taught a whole class on neoliberalism. I've never actually wanted to. I mostly really continue to like teaching classic works in political theory, and also kind of coming at contemporary topics a little bit more sideways. But I have found this in the times when I have taught graduate seminars that have had neoliberalism as a focus. It works better if there's something else going on. And what I mean is, I once taught a Marx and neoliberalism course. I've taught sovereignty and neoliberalism. So it works better for me to unfold its features and explore and examine with students its features. If we have something that is, I almost want to say, a bit of a foil, like in Marx and neoliberalism, Marx is not dealing with neoliberal capitalism. He's dealing with a different order of capitalism in the 19th century. And that helped bring into sharpness, into relief, what is distinctive and what is not distinctive about neoliberalism, but also what's maybe missed by some of the great Marxist thinkers who have attempted to treat neoliberalism, but aren't willing to leave Marxism in order to do it. And what's gained by moving towards some other kinds of thinkers who don't hew as closely to Marxism as they attempt to bring neoliberalism into relief. With undergraduates, it's usually just been a week or two, and it's usually been at the level that I was just talking about with Libby. You know, here's what your life is like. It usually also follows a section on Marx, but here's what Marx in The Jewish Question or Das Kapital or the Communist Manifesto didn't anticipate that we live now and call capitalism or neoliberalism. So again, some kind of foil, some kind of contrast, some kind of, not so much before and after, but discontinuity or rupture helps me at least bring it into relief. I don't tend to teach a lot of cultural texts, but I think that would be the other way to do it. You hang with what you do best, and what I do best is political theory.
Thank you. So before we go to sort of the winding down as we wrap up, I just wanted to share or ask about the relationship between, you know, your argument in the book and the book itself and what it addresses on the one hand, and the manifestations of neoliberalism globally at the broader systemic level, but also at the individual level of states, especially where states where publics crave economic well-being and political voice or empowerment, dubbed democracy. So this is about larger systemic processes, but it's also about how the concept travels, how the form of reason that you address, that is embodied by neoliberalism travels, and whether it does, and are there prerequisites a la, you know, various theories. This is just important because we hear and we write and we research when it comes to the developing world, for instance, in my case, in the Middle East, whereby neoliberalism is a major dimension. Is there a danger in trying to assume that there is an applicability that doesn't have to take into consideration various factors? Or if you can address this question about the traveling power of neoliberalism as we experience it in the United States.
You know, that's a big question. I want to remind us that the first experiments with neoliberalism were imperial experiments in Latin America.
Chile.
And exactly. And then to some degree, Argentina, and similarly, some in Africa, less well known, and even a little bit in the Middle East. But, you know, Chile is the obvious, the Chicago Boys overt, you know, all of that. But the question you ask almost implies that it's, you know, born in the Euro-Atlantic world and then traveling outward. And I think it's important for us to remember that some of the hard neoliberalization in the 70s and the 80s and the 90s not only happened through imperial imposition like Chile, but also in places like Thailand and elsewhere, where neoliberalizing those societies from the top down. I mean, there's this period in the 90s where the so-called prime minister of Thailand just starts referring to himself as its CEO. I mean, he's overt about it. We are now, you know, we're a small firm, not a country, and we're going to run like a small firm. And that, you know, it was neoliberalism, we would say today, on steroids.
And that's before Trump.
Yeah, way before Trump. And, you know, it's, well, the Clintons are having a neoliberal party, but it's not us doing it to Thailand. These ideas are being taken up for all kinds of reasons. They're disseminated in all kinds of ways. The larger question I think you're asking that is so important, Quinn Slobodian has been useful here, and so have some others, in thinking about how neoliberalism disseminates around the world as without a point of origin, but also through transnational institutions like the World Bank, like the IMF, like the United Nations, like the NGOification of the developing world, which, you know, is an enormously important site of disseminating neoliberal governance. The excitement about microcredit for women in agricultural regions, all these NGOs going and offering all of these women, you know, little bits of money to self-invest and start, you know, little industries and farm operations, connected with, in many cases, or articulating with, in many cases, agribusiness, Monsanto, and the rest of them. So neoliberalization there happens through this complex connection of well-meaning NGOs offering empowerment. That's another compelling term that neoliberalism offers, empowerment of individuals in the developing world, combined with the Monsantoification of agriculture that ends up generating cycles of debt and toxicity. So I'm not answering your question very directly, Bassam.
No, I mean,
I think the other piece of it is, what about the transformation of democracy? But we're talking about the transformation of something else. And what about when neoliberalism forms, it connects politically and socially to Maoism, to whatever you want to call the regimes, for example, in Iran and Iraq at this point, although Iraq is another example of the U.S. Essentially producing a neoliberalized state through the post-Ba'athist regime. I think one can even see it in the neoliberalization of Palestine through Israel, through the United States, through forms of aid and governance and so forth. But the dissemination question, I'm just throwing things at it rather than answering it very systematically.
No, I mean, it's a very difficult issue because we have, of course, a huge expanse and very different types of cases, some without, quote unquote, the trappings of democracy, however cynical we want to be about the definition of democracy in the West. So it's actually a very pleasant form, just as you shared earlier about where it started. And we are really interested. I am also very interested in not the issue of neoliberalism being a force that produces social polarization and produces these economic inequalities. I'm also interested in the form of reason that it espouses and how this sort of reason is adopted by political leaders and people in power, economically or politically elsewhere. And there is a striking similarity between the thought processes of the people that espouse neoliberalism in the United States and people that I know of in, for instance, the Middle East region that espouse that sort of, I mean, this is actually what's interesting, despite all sorts of differences in terms of economics, politics, yeah, and relations. So this is, no, thank you very much. I mean, I maybe it was not fair to throw
at
you.
It's a really important question. And, you know, it's also important for me to be forthrightly humble here about the limits of my own knowledge. I just, you know, we all know, like, you know, what we know, and then we try to know more. And it should always move out into the globe rather than grow more narrow as we try to know more.
Great. And this is our final question. And, you know, in 3 minutes or less, we are wondering what you see in today's political, social, or economic world where you might see alternatives to neoliberalism taking shape, taking hold in a, you know, in a way that is more fleeting, I would say, you know, perhaps more permanent, or perhaps a different, you know, way of thinking about it. Or what are the weak links in the march of neoliberalism?
Well, I think there are plenty of weak links revealing themselves right now, despite Biden going back to Larry Summers for his economic consultation at the beginning of his presidency, which I think astonished a lot of people. You know, in many ways, its generation of woeful inequalities, an absolute failure to respond to the emergency of climate change, and inability to respond to the injustices that movements around the world are revealing, from farmers in India to Extinction Rebellion and the Sunrise Movement and Black Lives Matter and Standing Rock in the United States. I think there are many ways in which neoliberalism is, as it were, discredited today, especially called into question by a younger generation, even as they are born into its form of reason. They're also questioning not even just neoliberalism, but capitalism across the board. And I think that the answer to your direct question, where do we see possibilities limiting other futures, other alternatives, are in these social and political movements around the world, from from Bolsonaro's Brazil to as I said, various movements in this country. And I think the clarity with which many young people understand capitalism in general, neoliberalism in particular, as having brought us to the brink of total destruction in the form of climate change, but also in the form of a hostility to forms of commonness, common care, common good, caring for the commons and caring for ourselves and other species in common. It is just remarkable to me how self-taught, or we could say self-revealing, the lack of that. Let me start again. It's remarkable to me how much of the younger, and here I'm just saying, you know, again, I'll say Gen Z and millennial generations, just know that capitalism is not a healthy system for them, for the world, for the possibility of a future. And know that neoliberalism in particular has left them stranded in terms of a future, individual and collective. And I think that is true across a set of races and classes. I think that the excitement about self-branding and self-promotion and self-entrepreneurship has pretty much quieted for a lot of this generation, even as they still feel compelled to do it to take care of themselves. And the social movements we have seen in the past 10 years since, you know, in this country, since Occupy, in the Middle East, since the Arab Spring, even Second Intifada, I think, you know, in Latin America, in extraordinary feminist and ecological movements and social justice movements, I think we are seeing all kinds of rebellions against not only neoliberal economics, but neoliberal reason and the belief that only that markets are inevitable, that they are the only way to live, and the belief that what we call extractive capitalism is essential, and the belief that racial justice can never be achieved. There's an extraordinary rebellion against all of this, and it is the hope of the future.
Great. Thank you so much. One of the things we would like to do on our podcast is to always end with these kind of visions and possibilities and alternatives, something that we feel like, you know, politics with our sense, the Tina sense, that there is no alternative, to always be unfolding what these other alternatives are and what these different imaginaries for what a different, more just and fair world could be. So thank you for that.
Thanks. Thanks so much, Wendy. This has been a full hour, and there's a lot to process. I myself would actually like to go back and listen to some of the answers as we were, you know, also producing at the same time. We don't have a separate producer doing this, but I would love to engage more. And we have actually no more time, and we did not budget for Q&A. We have one question that we could put to you via email, but in Theory Buzz podcast, we are not budgeting so far for Q&A because we need that full hour to get a sense from the author about the book and its various dimensions. But we are infinitely appreciative that you came on as our first guest, and we are also looking forward to hosting several guests in the future, including, and I'll put this online, including Mahmoud Mamdani on March 18th, on Thursday also at 2 p.m., and Achille Mbembe on April 15th also at 2 p.m., and I presume it is a Thursday as well, each discussing their new volume, their new book, and more to come. Without further ado, I'd like to thank you again so much, Wendy. Libby, do you have any final words for people who might be watching or listening?
No, just thanks for tuning in, and we're looking forward to continuing the conversation. And thank you again, Wendy. We're really grateful to get a chance to chat with you and hear your insights.
Absolutely.
And Libby, thank you for great questions and indulging my long answers. And I will say to your audience, they're incredibly lucky to have Mahmoud and Achille next. So, go forth. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And everyone, all right, take care. Wendy, thank you so much. And everyone else watching, we will be producing this podcast and placing it on various platforms, including YouTube, iTunes, and it'll always be on theorybuzz.com in audio form, so you can watch.
Afternoon, you're tuned to Butcher T's Noontime Cuts, hitting every Friday from noon to 2, playing your wide variety of music just to make your afternoon delight just right. So stay locked to CKT 90.3 FM.
Smoke a bit, some fat ass blunt.